This is called, aren't they all just dead white males? Why read the classics? Perhaps it follows on nicely from Mike's lecture just now. Yes, I am a white man. I'm going to talk to you about the classics and, yeah, the dead white males. Firstly, to begin with, let's just think about what a classic is before we launch into the rest of it. What is a classic? Traditionally, there are a number of objective criteria and then also some subjective criteria, which is good because reality has subjectivity and objectivity. So let's look at the objective criteria, some of them at least. And just before we begin, it's not as though every single classic will necessarily have every one of these characteristics, but it should have at least some. It should have probably most of them, I guess. But these are some of the things that traditionally have made something a classic. The first one would be superiority or excellence. So you can already see we're getting into dangerous waters right there. Before we've even started, you can see why. Right, but we'll get to this. But traditionally, some texts were seen as superior, qualities of excellence. So form, content, expression needs to be quite exceptional. You know, the best among its class. So amongst novels, it would be things like Tolstoy's novels, Dostoevsky's novels, Jane Austen's novels. They've got to be pretty good. Right, there's a superiority amongst their class, excellence. So their form might be more complex than others. Their content will be multifaceted. The expression will be, they'll be well expressed, okay, things like that. There's also the quality of endurance. So the idea that they're both timeless and timely. So they stand the test of time, they continue to speak to each successive generation. So they're timely at each point in history, some way. So in other words, there's probably something universal about them, which enables them to continue to be relevant. They are influential. They tend to be texts that exert cultural influence within a culture and then across successive cultures. So you think of a text like Homer's epics, for example. They're Bronze Age oral poems that have continued to exert influence through many different periods of history, and people who speak many different languages and have found them to be influential, for example. There's a sense in which they're inexhaustible. So they continue to speak afresh. This is related to that sense of them being timeless and timely, I guess. They keep speaking through both an individual's lifetime. As you keep reading it as an individual, you come back, you can revisit these texts throughout your life, and they'll keep speaking. And you'll find that they say different things to you at different points in your life, depending on what you're going through, or your level of maturity, or your experiences. They're capable of almost like a dialogue with you through your life, but then also not just individuals, across cultures as well. As time passes, even societies will draw out different, as a society is thinking about, concerned with different issues or different concerns, it'll often keep finding, as the culture moves, it'll find it can keep mining these texts. So yeah, there's a lot there. They're inexhaustible. They're also multifaceted, so they're rich, dense, complex. So you might have something that's an allegory, that's the surface storyline may be quite engaging in itself, and then there might be an allegorical layer as well, which so there's multiple levels going on, for example. So there's a density. You can keep mining them, and in an academic context, you can keep finding new angles and new... They don't simply allow necessarily for one simple interpretation. They will often allow for different interpretations. The meaning isn't just on the surface. There's depth to be plumbed, right? So they're in a sense thick as opposed to thin. You could think of it like that. Not thick as in intellectually challenged, dense in that sense, but they're rich as depth. And they tend to contain universal truths about human beings and life, which are embodied in the particulars of a story. So they touch on that particular and universal, what's that word? That sort of dynamic between, you know, they've both got, by using a particular story in a particular place and time, particular characters, they touch on universal things that are true for all people, all times, in all places. This is the idea. And as part of that, they'll often have archetypes. So they'll have characters or plots that recur across cultures and through time. Like the hero slaying the monster to defend the community, something like that. You'll find that recurs. You'll find it in Chinese literature. You'll find it in Babylonian. You'll find it in Greek, and you find it in Norse, Old Norse. You know, different things. So they tend to be archetypical, have archetypes. And then for the subjective criteria, I only have one, but there might be others. So this is a workshop, so you can help me, you can suggest more, but they tend to be quite moving. They tend to affect us deeply when we experience them. So they should be, now again, they don't have to be. You can acknowledge something's a classic that doesn't move you, because there are those objective criteria, but quite often, at least for a substantial number of people, a certain classic text will be some kind of landmark experience for them, intellectually, emotionally, spiritually. You know, you might feel like, I'm not the same person I was before I read this. This is a mile. You know, and you always remember that time you finished War and Peace, and you just felt elevated, or you felt you had experienced life in a richer way, or something like that. What do I mean for the purposes of this workshop? What do I mean when I'm saying classics? Obviously, every culture has its classics, I would say, and every discipline and field. So there are scientific classics, in a sense. There are English literature classics. There are history classics. There are psychological classics, maybe Freud and Jung might be classics of the psychological disciplines, for example. For the purposes of this workshop, I'm happy to go wherever you want to go, but I'm thinking particularly Western classics, the great books, that Vishal's alluded to, for example. I'm taking a literary bent, so that is my area of expertise. Again, we wouldn't only have to talk about these, but I'm thinking Western, I'm thinking literature mainly, and I'm thinking as big a span of time as possible. So Homer to Harry Potter via Herbert, for example, or the Bible to Marilyn Robinson, who I think will prove to be, if she's not already confirmed, as a classic author. And you can have classic texts and you can have classic authors. It's not exactly the same thing. So you might have a classic author. Not every single thing they write is classic, but they've written enough that. So anyway, but Marilyn Robinson, I would think, is well on her way at the very least to being a classic author. But I haven't read her books, so again, I'm going by those objective criteria. I haven't got the subjective one for her because I haven't personally experienced her books. But looking at those objective ones, I can see it already from what people have told me, and etc. What are some of the things that make the classic seem difficult to us? What can you offer anything? I have a few thoughts, but what are your thoughts? What makes, because the classics can seem, you feel like you ought to read them, or you have to read them at school, you have to study them, and that can sometimes kill the Before you've even had a chance to develop an appreciation, you've already been put off because you had to read a text you weren't really ready for, and you had to write about it, and it was just terrible, and you did poorly, and you know, it was a pain, and you know, there's all these. So there's barriers in our way to the classics, but can you? Maybe I've just listed them all, but you know, are there others? Are there others you can think of?
The burden of figuring out which translation is the right one.
Yeah. Yes, the burden of figuring out which translation. Yep.
Reading that translation, even in the English, sometimes the English translation of it, well, like the, even the Holy Bible in the King James, that 1611.
Yes.
Really hard to read. I was trying to read that one.
Right, yes. Some translations can be much harder to read than others. Absolutely, Anna, yes. Yes, Brian.
Some of them are long. So if you're going to read Proust, you have to block out 8 months.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm really slow reading them, especially the way my life, the shape of my life. I don't read as much as I would like to of the classics. I'm interested in them, and some of them I know and love well, and there's a whole bunch of them that I'm waiting to get to. But yeah, the length is can be a real issue. Yes, the vocabulary can be difficult. Yeah, they sometimes use words that are very unusual, very long, obscure. Yeah, the denseness. Yeah, I find I have this problem where I think I'm a perfectionist, and I keep rereading parts to just make sure I've, you know, but then that breaks the flow sometimes. Or if it is quite dense and I'm tired or something, especially, I might get through a page of something that's fairly dense and then realize I've sort of wasn't concentrating for the second half of the page, and I have to go back and read again. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that can make it much longer. Well, I have just that they can be intimidating. You know, you have this sense of what if I don't like them, or they're just, yeah, the length, the things we've mentioned, the length, the difficulty sometimes of the language, the complexity, this can make them intimidating. I would say to encourage you, though, not all of them are equally dense, long, or difficult. So start in a suitable place for you. So one that I've been listening to, again, because I don't have a lot of time, I've been listening to the, several times last few years, I've listened to The Red Badge of Courage by Stephen Crane, which I would say is definitely a classic, but it's quite short, and it's not too hard. And I was just listening to an audiobook as I was driving to and from certain places, just listening to it. You know, you don't have to start with War and Peace. You can start with The Red Badge of Courage, which is much shorter. And has, like War and Peace, has some of the most incredible and compelling battle scene descriptions probably in literature. Remarkable little book. But it's not too long. It's not too dense. You know, you could start with that, and then that might help to lead you into something a bit longer. Also, I mentioned listening. I find listening can also help sometimes rather than trying to read it, because sometimes when you listen, you can just let it flow over you rather than having to, you know, to nut it all out on the page. So there are things you can do like that. Listening can help. Also, I would say the more time that you spend with them, the less intimidating they can become, hopefully. May not always be the case, but often it's the case that the more time you spend with them, gradually they can become less. They can become more familiar. You become more accustomed to these long sentences, and you find, oh, actually, this is a bit easier now than it was previously, because I've just trained myself more to read it. I think like anything substantial in life, it can take some investment of time, but I'm saying it's worth it, and also. Not doing it alone can be helpful. So reading and discussing with other people. So right now at English Library, there's a young Norwegian guy there called Ruben, who's with us this term, and he's reading, for the first time, he's reading Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov. And there's an American family staying with us too, and the father is a teacher, and he's taught the book a number of times. He knows it very well. And so Ruben's reading Brothers Karamazov in Norwegian and then meeting with Brent from Alabama, who's a teacher, and they're talking, they're meeting, you know, in their week at Labrie, they're meeting to chat about it, and he's telling him about the characters and helping him to navigate it. And Ruben said it's been so helpful having that. So it's good to do with other people. Read with other people, or read separately and discuss with other people, something like that. Okay, we should keep going. They can also just be boring and alien too. You know, often they're coming to us from a long time ago or from far away, different languages, translations. You know, they can just be a bit boring and a bit dry, or seem that way, and very foreign. So, and again, I would say they demand a lot from us, but they give a lot back. And we're going to come back to that a bit later. But you can sometimes push through that, or you can trust that this book. I sometimes tell myself, well, this book wouldn't be so famous if there wasn't something here. So I'm going to keep going. And maybe, you know, this is the thing. You're free. You're free not to finish the book. You know, you're free to say, look, I just don't think that one. My lifetime is limited. I only have so much. You know, I don't have to like Proust, you know, memory of things past. It's okay. You know, so you should free yourself not to have to like something or finish it. But they can be an acquired taste and require initiation, even from other people, initiating you into it. And so, you know, there's something to that. You can acquire the taste. It's like olives or mushrooms or, you know, red wine. You might not like it the first time you have it, but you can acquire the taste. And a lot of the best things in life actually acquire tastes, I would say. And it's a life principle that you do have to work at. Almost like the better something is, often the more you have to work to be able to appreciate it, versus something that's instantly gratifying often is more shallow. So hang in there, is what I'm saying. So, you know, we need help, but it's worth engaging with. And then the final one, which is, I think, maybe the most formidable one at the moment in our culture, is that they're offensive. They can be offensive. They can be difficult for us. Most they can be seen as a force for evil, or oppression, or perpetuating oppressive patterns or ways of thinking or structures. So I'm just going to look a little bit at why are the classics being cancelled? Some classics, at least in some quarters, they're being called to be cancelled, or really actually being cancelled. I found this is kind of humorous in a way, but the person writing about it is not really very sympathetic. So I'm sorry, in a sense, it's not more neutral, but it does capture something that's going on. So in December, a Massachusetts ninth grade English teacher proclaimed on Twitter that she was very proud to say we got the Odyssey removed from the curriculum this year. The Odyssey, a masterwork written 28 centuries ago, was not fully aligned with the teacher's contemporary moral compass. Rather, she felt that the Odyssey was spreading sexism, racism, ableism, and Western centrism. And this person sort of cheekily says, of course, the Odyssey was written in the Bronze Age, a couple of millennia before the concept of Westernism even existed. This person's quite scathing in a way. But you can see there this idea that the Odyssey is, in a sense, damaging because it has norms in it. It's depicting a society which is not, in some ways, not the kind of society we want to be building, right? So it's going to be a negative influence on us if we extol it and we read it and we imbibe it and this kind of thing. Spreading sexism, racism, ableism. And there's other examples. There's more sophisticated examples too. Like university professors who are not necessarily wanting to cancel texts but are wanting to approach them with a lot more qualifications and, in a sense, problematizing them, pointing out, you know, which is not necessarily a bad thing to do at all, to say there's some things here that are, you know, detrimental potentially, and let's name those. And then there are certain disciplines, like the discipline of specifically classics in the more technical sense of study of Greece and Rome, there's an argument that the modern day discipline of classics is part of this kind of Enlightenment project to put a certain kind of Western reason, notions of reason and whiteness at the top of a cultural pyramid and things like that. And I think it's valid to discuss that and try and be discerning about that. What do I have next here? Oh yeah, so this is another example. Disrupt, hashtag disrupt texts, which is... Disrupt texts is a... Let me see, I have something here on it. It's a movement, a movement that seeks to disrupt, cancel the teaching of various texts. And I guess recently they were talking about Shakespeare. And saying that Shakespeare's plays harbour problematic depictions and characterizations. They persist in indoctrinating students, interesting term, into a false notion of the primacy and superiority of the English language. They include violence, misogyny, racism, and they ultimately promote white supremacy and colonization, and therefore must be excluded from curriculums. I've read quite a bit of Shakespeare and watched quite a bit. I'm not so sure that he's doing all those things, but you can certainly see how people could react in some ways to him. That's another example. So that's a little bit of what's happening. Like I said, there are some more nuanced examples. But certainly we're much more ambivalent today about the classics. In the broad sense and in the narrow Greco-Roman sense than we have ever been. I just want to look at a few responses now, and maybe in the discussion time you may have more examples you want to talk about of the cancellation, but I should keep going. I would say the first thing is allowing for complexity is important. Allowing life to be complex and these texts to be complex. It doesn't, and because we respect them and enjoy them and uphold them, and maybe they could even be have a central place in our education system, doesn't mean that we shouldn't be discerning about them, or we shouldn't that we should just endorse everything about them, obviously. So an example of someone I think who's doing this would be Mary Beard. There's a number of TV series in England on the BBC where she talks about ancient Rome. Interesting documentary series about ancient Rome that she's done. So she's quite famous in the UK, Mary Beard. She's written some books too on Pompeii and the Roman Empire. And she says, "I deplore the lack of diversity in the classical profession, but to condemn classical culture would be as simplistic as to offer it unconditional admiration. My line has always been that the duty of the academic is to make things seem more complicated." So I think that's an example of someone who acknowledges. If you've ever got the chance, you should go onto YouTube sometime and watch her debating Boris Johnson about whether the Greeks were better or the Romans were better. It's fantastic. It's from when Boris Johnson was mayor of London, so it's before he was prime minister. But he studied classics at Eton and Oxford, and he loves classics. He's an enthusiastic amateur classicist whose day job is a politician. She's a professional academic. But he spoke on behalf of the Greeks, and she spoke on behalf of the Romans. It was just wonderful. But something she was, and he was basically taking the line, the Greeks are more into free thinking and freedom, and the Romans are just imperial bastards who conquer everyone and brutalize everything, and they're terrible. And Mary Beard said she didn't try, and this is part of her complexity stance. She didn't deny anything he said about the Romans, but she just said, "But isn't that quite interesting? And don't you think they're kind of like us? Don't you think we could, we can see ourselves in them? That could be worth doing." So she's an interesting thinker. And then Dennis Feeney, when I studied classics, he was often on we'd be assigned to write an essay about this text, this ancient text, and he'd often be in the reading list, Dennis Feeney. So his name is familiar to me from my student days. But he says, "In some moods, I feel that this is just a moment of despair, and people are trying to find significance, even if it only comes from self-accusation. I'm not sure that there is a discipline that is exempt from the fact that it is part of the history of this country. How distinctly wicked is classics? I don't know that it is. And he's at Princeton, as you can see, professor of classics at Princeton. He's a Kiwi, but has been at Princeton for a long time. And I think this allowing for complexity is one thing. One part of that is not to give in to reductionism. And often I think what happens is everything is reduced to power. And I think that power dynamics are really important. They're not unimportant. They are important. And it's important to think about them and see what's happening in a particular cultural story in terms of power and abuse of power. But I don't think everything should be reduced to power. I think there's more to human life and human experience than that. And the classics depict, they immerse us in human experience in a particularly rich way. So I think it would be a shame to reduce them merely to their power dynamics. And to acknowledge the complexity and the messiness of things. So like the Iliad has a lot of violence, a lot of exploitation. And that can be very hard, especially for us now. I think for the original audience, they probably enjoyed the battle scenes and the spears going through the cheeks and the teeth and coming out the other side, and you know, that Homer describes quite graphically. Maybe more than we do now. Maybe that's unfair of me to put that on them, but I wonder, I suspect they might have enjoyed that a bit more than we would now. But this is part of what I was saying about how they speak. They can say different things. Different cultures can find different things in them. There's also amazing love and compassion in the Iliad too, and just incredible depictions of grief, the depths of human grief and things like that. So they're not merely violent, they're not merely exploitative, right? There's a lot more going on. Fini is responding to this idea that during the Enlightenment, the study of Greece and Rome was elevated in a way that's now being seen as detrimental. And so I think his observation is really interesting. I think at the same time, I don't feel any need to defend the Enlightenment project and the way it's used the classics of Greece and Rome. So during the Enlightenment, the study of the Greco-Roman classics was used in a way to give Europe a new secular origin story. So you cast off the Bible, the oppression of the God of the Bible, the whole Jewish stream to us, which is seen as detrimental, and you embrace Greece and Rome, well, that's really where we're from. You know, that's where we see democracy and drama and philosophy and the roots of all those. So that's really where we're from, and embracing as an alternative authority to the Bible. And they were sometimes used to justify Enlightenment era hierarchies of culture and race. So, you know, Aristotle talks about slaves as being inherently inferior as people. That's not a biblical idea, but it is a strong classical idea. And so slave owners in the United States in the past would appeal, they would appeal to Aristotle at times. And then the classics have also been used, this is where it's complicated, they've also been used to appeal to freedom and justice, because you also get that in the classics too. So you get like Pericles' speech, his funeral speech from ancient Athens, where he talks about the freedom of ancient Athens and the soldiers who've died fighting Sparta died to defend the freedom of our, and in our state everyone participates in the government. And so we also look back to that and we cherish that, but then we look back to other things they've said and we find them abhorrent. So it's complex, and they've been used in different ways in different periods of time, and it's good to acknowledge that. And like I said, I don't feel any obligation to defend the sort of Enlightenment hierarchies of race and culture by any means, but there was almost, as they were trying to get rid of the Bible and find some other source of beauty and authority and heritage, there was sometimes an unhelpful latching onto the classics as the supreme human achievements of all time and this kind of thing. And by implication, everything else is inferior. So the other cultures that they were colonizing and things were, by definition, inferior. So it could reinforce some of that colonization and racism. So I would very much agree that we don't want to do that, and it's a good idea to get away from that. By contrast, I'd say, you know, it's the Bible that actually gives us universal human dignity and value, not the pagan classics. But the Bible is also a classic of Western culture, so it's complicated. But, you know, both Bible and pagan classics have been used and misused, used well and used poorly through time. Okay. And as a Christian, I would say, what about the author's intention and context? Well, you have to also treat the author as a human being, give them the dignity of having had a particular intention. I think there's often, with this sort of cancel culture mentality, there's a determination to not take into account the intention or the context of anything. And I think that's a real problem. You know, is this story propaganda for something terrible, or is it simply taking place in a world that's different to ours? There's a difference. I think there's a difference between those two. But, you know, the entire canon from Greeks and Romans to now is not above criticism. And in many ways, the great books, as they've come to be known more recently, are in some ways this you know, like Vishal mentioned, this humanist creation. And so, yeah, we can absolutely take that with a grain of salt. And, you know, the canon is not above criticism at all. And it's affected by the fall, I would say as a Christian, it's deeply affected by the fall. But we must be free to explore it and enjoy it and critique it. We need to be discerning. I'd say there's a difference between describing or clarifying evil for us in a story and promoting it. There's a difference between, so back to the criticism of Shakespeare or the Odyssey that we saw earlier. I think that's a very clumsy description of those texts in the sense that, yes, they contain instances of some of those things in them. Misogyny, for example, maybe. There are instances where that might be there. But to automatically equate that with therefore they're promoting it and pushing it on us, I think is a bit of a leap. And literature immerses us in human experience. And human experience is not safe or comfortable or pleasant. Far from it. Human experience is full of malevolence and tragedy. And so literature cannot be merely safe either. Life isn't, and neither should literature, I would say. So, you know, just because we're immersed in these stories that aren't always safe, does that mean we're necessarily, inevitably being indoctrinated with their values? And are we just bound to keep perpetuating the destructive patterns that we see in some of these texts? Well, I would say no. I don't think we're just helpless victims of the stories we read. I think we have agency and awareness. We can discern, we can think, okay? We can sift them, basically. Anyway, another thing is just, yeah, acknowledging the beauty and the brokenness, I guess, is part of what I'm saying there. You know, these texts have beauty and they have brokenness. Should we deny ourselves the beauty because we don't want to be tainted by the brokenness? Again, I don't think life is like that in general. You know, am I going to grow up and distance myself from my parents, just completely cut myself off and be estranged from my parents because they're broken? But there's also beauty in them as well, and they've given me so much. You know, so life's not that simple. We can't just seek to remain untainted by the brokenness and just get rid of everything. Also, I think it's good to think about the fact that the canon is not fixed. It is fluid. And in a sense, everyone can draw up their own canon too. It's not an absolute thing set in stone. Various people have proposed certain canons over time, but you know, we're free to add and subtract to it, and that's fine. It's not definitive. And they're not all dead white males in the Western canon. There are, you know, Europe was white for a long time, and so that's reflected in the cultural artifacts that it's left behind, and that's the historical fact of it. But there've also been women authors who have also been part of the canon for some time as well, and there's no reason why it can't grow with a much more diverse body of authors as we have become more culturally diverse and racially diverse. There's no reason why the canon is not a closed thing. I think it can keep growing. And I would finally say to you that content, I think that I would argue, try and encourage you that the content is more important than the author's identity group. I think that that we are human. We are all human. And so there's no reason why we can't enjoy one another's work. In a sense, all of the achievements of humans everywhere, in a sense, to some level, belong to all of us as fellow humans. And I would say that it's reductionist ideologies that try to restrict us and forbid us, because if something doesn't fit within the confines of the ideology, if it doesn't promote the ideology, it's seen as a threat. I think I was saying this yesterday. I might have said this yesterday as well. I think we are free to explore and discern because we have something to discern against. We have something to measure things against, namely the Bible, which as God's revelation from outside is transcendent. So it's a transcendent measure that we can confidently measure things against. We don't have to be afraid of being overpowered by something bad. What else do I have here? Yeah, right. Are we simply conditioned by our stories? I think that the ideologies tend to want to condition us often, and I don't think that that's, I don't think that we're only formed by conditioning. I don't think we're at the mercy of these things as much. I think we can discern them. And then what do I have? Oh, my other question is, does cancelling something, does it solve the problems of the human heart and human society? It seems like there's this idea that if we expose ourselves to just only the right sort of things, then we'll be, that will somehow change who we are. It will transform our society and our hearts. And it seems like that's the idea, that this is why it's so important to cancel certain things and promote certain things. But I would really question that, whether cancelling books will really change who we are or how our society is. I think it's more complicated. Okay. I've spent quite a bit of time there on the cancelling stuff. I'm just going to move now into why read the classics, and it's going to be a more positive. So, okay, why do I think we should read them? They're more fun. They're more entertaining. There's just so much more to them. So they may require more work, might take longer to be able to appreciate the fun, but once you acquire the taste for them, once you do that hard work, they're just so much more entertaining than other texts. They're more interesting, they're more fun. So I know we're in the United States, fun is a very important value for you guys, so I thought I would, you know, it's one of your highest values. So... I get that. So here you go. It's more fun. There you go. Enough said. We can probably go to questions now. I also think, obviously they have a greater degree of technical and artistic excellence than other works. They tend to. I'm generalizing here, but they tend to. It's one of the features of them. So things like unity, coherence, progression, repetition, balance, symmetry, contrast, clarity combined with multiplicity. They have all these things that make them more satisfying aesthetically. More beauty in a way, hence more delight, I would argue. So heightened aesthetic enjoyment. They are profoundly enriching. So literature is the subject of literature is the concrete portrayal of human experience. And classics offer a fuller, richer portrayal of human experience. So we imaginatively enter into the essence of human experience with them more profoundly. They just give us a more fully realized world to experience. They have greater psychological depth, often more subtlety, complexity to them. Matthew Arnold wrote, "The best poetry will be found to have a power of forming, sustaining, and delighting us as nothing else can." Like I was saying, I also think that we can be discerning, we can resist that to some extent if we're not happy with what they're doing to us. But they a reason to read them is that there's a lot of good in them, and that they do amongst other things, form us, but also delight us. And C.S. Lewis says, those of us who have been true readers all our life seldom fully realize the enormous extension of our being which we owe to authors. We realize it best when we talk with an unliterary friend. Ooh, that's a bit harsh. The man who is contented to be only himself is in prison. Okay, so Lewis was a bit of a curmudgeon. You know, it's okay. He was Northern Irish. I mean, they're pretty tough people. Anyway, but you know, he's a little bit rude there to people who just don't like to read much. But I think there's something that it's the enormous extension of our being that I think he's hitting on something. Whoops, I'm not sure why that did that. Where are we? So yeah, more fun, aesthetic, profound enrichment. They're high cost and high reward. Yeah, like I said earlier, because they are more difficult, they demand more from us, but they also enrich us more. So they're more challenging, but they also give more back, right? You have to put more in, but they give more back. And they can bring the best out of us. In an academic setting, in a formal educational setting, they often bring out the best of us in response. So Leyland Ryken, who's a literature professor, was for many years at Wheaton, he said that his students tended to do their best work when they were engaging with more difficult writers like Shakespeare or Milton or Tolstoy or something like that. It would tend to draw out better work from them, which is interesting. They also give us the opportunity to wrestle with great ideas. So qualification is, we don't want to reduce the masterworks of literature merely to their ideas. They're not just sets of ideas. So sometimes people can get carried away with that. We don't want to reduce them to their ideas, but we can observe that one of their greatest services to us is the fact that they bring important, profound questions, the big questions of life, to us. They confront us with the big questions. They're an avenue to encounter the great issues, problems, challenges, and mysteries of life, such as suffering or love. This does not mean that they always tell us the truth, necessarily, but they stimulate our thinking about ideas, which hopefully sharpens our understanding of truth. Okay, so they can become our teachers and our friends in that sense throughout our lives, inviting us into the great conversation that's been going on for centuries through culture. They also give us a perspective from the past. So many of them are from the past, often the very distant past, like the Bronze Age. You know, in the Iliad and the Odyssey, they don't have iron yet. They're very old. And so the classics give us contact with these past worlds, and that's significant for several reasons. One thing is that it forces us to imagine a world very different to our own. And this, I think, helps with empathy. It helps to develop empathy. They place us in a past world. So it's a world that's different to our own in that it's often from the deep past, but it's also just someone else's world as well, a different person's world. So all literature does that, whether it's past or present. Sometimes they might even put us in a future world if they're science fiction or something like that. And I think this can help us to develop empathy, love, concern for others. And we can even learn about ourselves through seeing ourselves mirrored in something else. And they also give us a distance from which to see our own times in a different light and from a different perspective. In a sense, they liberate us from bondage to the contemporary. I quite like that. That's from Leyland Ryken. They liberate us from bondage to the contemporary. And here's a quote from Lewis that's talking about this. Learning in wartime. He says, we need intimate knowledge of the past. Not that the past has any magic about it, but because we need something to set against the present. The person who knows the past has lived in many times and is therefore in some degree immune from the great cataract of nonsense that pours from the press and the microphone of his own age. Okay, freeing us from the bondage of the contemporary. And also immersing us in an unfamiliar world with a different culture, assumptions, beliefs. Yeah, it can be confronting. We could find it difficult, but it may also expand our view of human possibilities. Oh, a society could be like that. Oh, that's interesting. Things could be different, you know. So that can help us when we see how differently we think and act sometimes compared to our forebears. It gives us a sense of our place in time. our contemporaneity, C.S. Lewis said. T.S. Eliot said that. So our sense of where we are in history. And it can be a catalyst for clarifying our thinking. So we might think, oh yeah, they did that very differently. I'm really glad we don't do it like that anymore. Or, maybe that would be interesting. It would be interesting to live in a society that thought that way. Maybe we could learn from it, or something like that. And I think because of their complexity, they help us to guard against reductionism, because they are subtle and they offer different readings and things like that. So it's difficult to just reduce them to one very simple thing, and that's helpful. And they can also, I think, shape our longings and our affections towards goodness, because we come to love and admire these certain characters and we want to emulate them. We think, yes, we see a picture of what we want to be like, often with good characters. Or we see a picture of evil that really reminds us what we don't want to be like. So I think they can be very helpful in that way. I wanted to just look at some examples from the classics now of some of these things. I can only be very limited. Time is short. But I'm going to just try and do a little bit of demonstrating, or just let's look a bit at we've been talking about them. Let's just look at them for a moment. This is for you, Bob, because every time Bob sees me, he asks me what I'm reading every few years, and I say, oh yeah, I'm still reading The Faery Queen, because it's so long. It's the longest poem in the English language. It's about 35,000 lines. So for comparison, the Iliad's about 15,000 lines. The Odyssey's about 12,000 lines. Faery Queen's 35,000, and it's unfinished. It was going to be 12 books or 24 books, and he got to about six. He got through about six, and it's still the longest poem. So, Bob, this is just for you. I was hoping you'd be here. So, this is from The Faery. This is the very beginning of the poem, The Faery Queen, book one. It's an epic poem, 1590, Edmund Spenser. It's a sort of Protestant allegorical fantasy epic poem, romance. It's got so many layers. It's all the richness I was talking about. It's that on steroids. Okay, this is how it goes. We'll just read a few stanzas and then I'll talk about the form a bit. So it says, a gentle knight was pricking on the plain. I've left the original spelling so you can enjoy that. It clad in mighty arms and silver shield, wherein old dints of deep wounds did remain, the cruel marks of many a bloody field. Yet arms till that time did he never wield. His angry steed did chide his foaming bit, as much disdaining to the curb to yield. Full jolly knight he seemed, and fair did sit, as one for knightly jousts and fierce encounters fit. And on his breast a bloody cross he bore, the dear remembrance of his dying lord, for whose sweet sake that glorious badge he wore, and dead as living ever him adored. Upon his shield the like was also scored, for sovereign hope, which in his help he had. Right faithful, true he was in deed and word, but of his cheer did seem too solemn sad, yet nothing did he dread, but ever was idrad, dreaded. Upon a great adventure he was bound, that greatest Gloriana to him gave, that greatest glorious queen of fairyland, to win him worship and her grace to have, which of all earthly things he most did crave. And ever as he rode, his heart did yearn to prove his puissance in battle brave, upon his foe and his new force to learn, upon his foe a dragon horrible and stern. There's quite a lot that's not easy in many ways. There's a lot of complexity there, but there's also music and colour. And there's some intriguing mysteries too. He's a brand new knight, inexperienced, but he has this really old dented armor. What's that all about? Maybe we'll get back to some of the content. Firstly, just though, to think about the form. What did you notice about this stanza form? This is called the Spenserian stanza. He invented this stanza. And it's fiendishly demanding. It's a Herculean meter that he's come up with. This is what we're saying about classics being a next level. I wanted to use it as an example of primarily richness and complexity just of literary form, but there's already some complexity of content even in those first three stanzas. It consists of 8 lines of iambic pentameter. That's where there's 5 beats. A gentle knight was pricking on the plain, clad in mighty arms and silver shield. So there's 5 beats. It's like Shakespeare uses that a lot, iambic pentameter. But then the last line is a bit longer. It's 6 beats. So it's a hexameter. Instead of a pentameter, it's a hexameter. Instead of 5 beats, it's 6 beats. So that's quite interesting. The first line, sure, typically has a break. A gentle knight was pricking on the plain, something like that. The final line. So as one for knightly jousts and fierce encounters fit. The final line typically has a break, right, sort of halfway through. So it's a longer line with a little bit of a break partway through. The rhyme scheme is A-B-A, B-B, C-B, C-C. I don't know if you can see it at the bottom, I've laid it out, but that's really hard. You have to find 4 B rhymes for every stanza, 3 C rhymes, and 2 A rhymes. That's really demanding. And Spencer, just stanza after stanza, just 35,000 lines worth, and it's unfinished. And they just roll off his pen, and they very rarely feel forced or like he's grasping for the right rhyme or the right word. Now, in Italian, these kinds of rhyme schemes, this is more complex than anything, but these kind of rhyme schemes were popular on the European continent amongst the Latin languages, which are much easier to rhyme. Because, you know, all the nouns end in O or A, or, you know, it's much easier. With a Germanic-based language like English, it's much harder to rhyme. And that's why Germanic languages traditionally do alliteration. They're based on stress and repetition of consonants, alliteration, rather than vowels, because they're just different. But Spencer, yeah, he likes the challenge of taking a really difficult rhyme scheme and making it work for English, but it's so beautiful. It's so gorgeous and dense and colourful, but doesn't feel forced. So he's amazing in that sense. But the rhyme scheme's pretty tough. But it's interesting because each stanza also has this, all those interlocking rhyming endings, the A, B, and C, the way they interlock, it pulls you forward through the stanza. There's a sense of motion and narrative drive. But then at the end of each stanza, you've got the C, C at the end, which is a couplet, a rhyming couplet, which kind of gives closure as well. Full jolly knight he seemed, and fair did sit, as one for knightly jousts and fierce encounters fit. It sort of rounds it off as well, gives a sense of completion. And sometimes these little couplets at the end will almost sound like a little proverb, a little saying, a little sort of, you know, nugget, which sort of pushes back against the flow. So you've got this ongoing, but then the next stanza just keeps going. Oh, whoops, I went the wrong way. The next stanza will just keep going. And on his breast, see, and it just keeps flowing on. A bloody cross he bore, but, and then it has another little bit of closure at the end, the last concluding couplet with the longer line at the end, sort of is like this little retardation, pushing against the flow, and then another one just comes again. So it's almost like waves of the sea coming in and pulling back and then coming in. And so it has this lovely to and fro to it, which is complex, right? Which is a next level in terms of form, but just gives so much more to it. Makes it a more multifaceted experience, right? Then you've got some of the content too. It's an allegory it's a Christian allegory. This first book of the Faery Queen, each book is concerned with a virtue, a different virtue. The first book is holiness. So this knight represents holiness. And the reason his armour is dinted is because it's the Christian armour that Paul talks about putting on. He tells Paul the Christian armour, you know, of faithfulness and hope and these kinds of things. And so the idea is he's put on this Christian armor that many before him have worn. Many Christians going, you know, way back over the centuries have worn this same armor. That's why it's all dinted and beaten up, which is that's quite clever. I quite like that, how he's done that. That's quite rich. So there's a surface story of this knight And he has all kinds of adventures, and they're just interesting. They're just entertaining in themselves. But then underneath, there's this layer of allegory about the Christian life. And then there's this deeper allegory, or this other allegorical level, of Elizabethan England as this Protestant nation. So Gloriana is Elizabeth I. She's the fairy queen, and the knights are all serving her. So they're like the nobles that used to serve her at her court. So there's all these. There's this national layer. There's the personal sort of Pilgrim's Progress, every Christian going through life layer. And then there's just this rich Arthurian fairyland fantasy world series of adventures, fighting dragons. So that, you know, that's at least three layers there, and there may well be more. So it's a rich poem. Okay, so that's an example, richness of form and content there. I just wanted to look at the Odyssey, since the Odyssey did get a bit of a slamming earlier from the ninth grade teacher, who was accusing it of all kinds of horrible things. I just wanted to quickly look at a couple of bits from the Odyssey. So Homer's epics are famous for their extended similes. They have these glorious long simile. So they'll say, and then he fell, like some soldier dies, you know, in the war. He fell. And it will say, like a pine tree when it falls on the slopes of, and it'll name, you know, Mount Hyperion, Mount, whatever, some mountain in Greece, when the axeman with his sharp bronze axe has, you know, and it goes into this little cameo description of a peacetime activity that then contrasts with the brutal war of the war world of the poem. It gives you all these glimpses of peaceful life, civilian life. And these vivid, beautiful similes full of beautiful imagery, and then it comes back to and it just enriches the narrative that way. So the Iliad is particularly rich in these, but the Odyssey has some really good ones too. And this is a really interesting one here, where Odysseus is at this feast. So he's washed up on this island where there's this sophisticated, civilized culture. And it's the first culture that doesn't try and seduce him, kill him, change him into something, prevent him from ever leaving. It's the first really good example of hospitality that he has, and they end up taking him home. So it's nearly the end of his journey, but his deeds are famous. The Trojan War is being sung about all over the world already. So he gets there, and they don't really know who he is. He's sort of this anonymous guest, and then they sing, their bard at the feast sings about Troy and sings about his triumph at Troy, right? So he's this, white imperialistic. He's not really white. He's an ancient Greek. Like Mike was saying, you know, this, it's anachronistic. We didn't even get to that, did we? Mike said it already, but, you know, this putting back of a modern sense of whiteness onto Homer is actually pretty crass anyway. He was a man of the ancient Mediterranean, so who knows exactly what he would have looked like, but he certainly wouldn't have looked German or something like that. Norwegian or something. But he's sitting there, and they're singing about his greatest moment of triumph of destroying Troy, and he just starts weeping. It's very interesting. So I'll read it. So it says, he sang then, this is the bard, he sang then how the sons of the Achaeans, that's the Greeks, left their hollow hiding place in the horse, right? And streamed from the horse and sacked the city. And he sang how one and another fought through the steep citadel, and how in particular Odysseus went, so he just happens to in particular be focusing on Odysseus, right? With godlike Menelaus, like Ares. So Odysseus in this song is being likened to Ares, the god of war, to find the house of Deiphobus. And there, he said, he endured the grimmest fighting that ever he had, but won it there too, with great-hearted Athene aiding. So Athene is a goddess of war. Ares is the god of war. He's likened to Ares, so he's being likened to the god of war. He's being assisted by the goddess of war, and he's just laying waste. He's just destroying everything. You know, he's destroying Troy. So it's his moment of greatest masculine warrior triumph, right? So the famous singer sang his tale. But Odysseus melted, and from under his eyes the tears ran down, drenching his cheeks. Now listen to this simile. This is extraordinary. As a woman weeps, lying over the body of her dear husband, who fell fighting for her city and people, as he tried to beat off the pitiless day from city and children, She sees him dying and gasping for breath, and winding her body about him, she cries high and shrill, while the men behind her, hitting her with their spear butts on the back and the shoulders, force her up and lead her away into slavery, to have hard work and sorrow, and her cheeks are racked with pitiful weeping. Who is Odysseus being likened to in his tears? Right. His victims, basically. He's being equated with his victims on some level, artistically. That's what the simile is doing. That's very interesting. Firstly, it should be said, there's a notion of kind of white masculinity that's maybe more recent, that men aren't supposed to cry. That's definitely not the case in the ancient world. Certainly not in southern Europe. Certainly not the Greeks and Romans. The Aeneid has been criticized for the heroes just crying all the time. Aeneas, the Roman, the founder of Rome, he's pathetic, he's always crying. They certainly didn't see tears and emotions as, in any sense, unmanly. But it is an amazing reversal, right? It's reversing. He's being likened, it's very pointed, he's being likened to a woman, exactly the kind of victim that he was creating in this, right? So it's meant to be his moment of greatest male triumph, martial triumph. He's like Ares, he's, you know, laying waste. And then his response is, he's been through so much trauma. The reality is he's actually a super traumatized, homesick soldier, and he just weeps like one of the women he's victimized in destroying Troy. I think that's extraordinary in terms of awareness. So it's not just a blindly imperialistic, misogynistic, I don't think. How could you argue that? How could the ninth grade teacher argue it's just misogynist, imperialistic? When you actually see, it's much more subtle, it's much more human, there's much more going on than that, right? It's an extraordinary, shocking, shocking reversal. Such were the pitiful tears, it finishes, Odysseus shed from under his brows, but they went unnoticed by all the others. But Alcinous alone understood what he did and noticed, since he was sitting next to him and heard him groaning heavily. So it's extraordinary. He's just sitting there weeping. There's an amazing, two amazing books you might be interested in. One's called Achilles in Vietnam, and the other one's called Odysseus in America. And it was a psychologist here in the States who worked with Vietnam veterans, and he found reading Homer with them was incredibly therapeutic for them. It got them talking about their experiences, and they said what they read in the Iliad and the Odyssey depicted exactly their experiences. They couldn't believe how accurately it depicted their experience of war and then of coming home. So the trauma of war and then how difficult it was to come home. Amazing books, remarkable. But attesting to how universal these texts are. These were Vietnam vets. They didn't read the classics. They didn't know who Homer was till this guy sat them down and had them read Homer together. And they just, it brought all this stuff out. It enabled them. So it was very amazing. So they're remarkable books. Achilles in Vietnam, Odysseus in America. Just one other one. This is when he gets home and he's reunited with his wife. Again, a simile, again, a reversal. Look at this. She spoke, so she's kind of tricked him. We can talk about it more if you want to, but she spoke, and still more aroused in him the passion for weeping. He wept as he held his lovely wife, whose thoughts were virtuous. And as when the land appears, welcome to men who are swimming, after Poseidon has smashed their strong-built ship on the open water, pounding it with the weight of wind and the heavy seas, and only a few escape the grey water landward by swimming, with a thick scurf of salt coated upon them, and gladly they set foot on the shore, escaping the evil. So welcome was her husband to her, as she looked upon him, and she could not let him go from the embrace of her white arms. I just wanted to show you this because it's a beautiful picture of their equality as husband and wife. Penelope's a remarkable character. She's consistently shown as really intelligent, really capable. She successfully fends off these legions of male suitors who are constantly pressuring her. And then when Odysseus finally comes, she's the only person in the Odyssey or the Iliad who ever outwits him. whoever can gets the better of him, because he's always getting the better of everyone through his cunning. And she actually outwits him with the bed that she draws out to prove who he is. She's skeptical, which she needs to be, and she says, "Oh, if you're really Odysseus, that's great. We'll just bring out your bed from our marriage chamber. We'll bring the bed out, and you can go to sleep in it." And the bed is built around a tree that's growing in their hall. So the bed is by definition fixed, rooted to the spot, but it's a secret that only they know about their bedroom. And so she uses it, because if he's really Odysseus, he'll know that you can't just bring his bed out through it. And then he says, you have me, and he describes the bed to her, and then she knows it's really him, because he knows that I can't bring the bed out. But the fact that she gets the better of him is unique in the poem. So that's the way that she's identified with him as an equal. But then the fact that the simile very pointedly likens her to the shipwrecked sailor that he is, right? He's the shipwrecked sailor who's come home. But it likens her in this moment to the shipwrecked sailor, and he's like the land that she's so grateful to have reclaimed. It's a fascinating reversal that identifies them with each other. You know, they're one flesh, man and wife. And I just think that's quite remarkable, that you would think the simile would be him. He's a shipwrecked sailor, you think, and you know, he's seeing her, but it actually flips it around. So in that, it identifies them, and it says that even though their experiences have been different, they're united, and her experience has been one of deprivation as well, and loneliness and exile, even in her own home too. So it's a remarkable, I think, equalizing and uniting of them as man and wife. I think, again, I think that's anything but misogynistic there. Now, it's not to say there aren't things in the Odyssey that we might find problematic or that we might not want to replicate in our society, things like slavery or the way that the women in the defeated towns are treated, of course, and all of that. But to simply write it all off as misogyny, you can see, is a crazy idea, right? There's clearly complexity. There's a lot more to it than just that.